Norway pauses to remember the 76 people confirmed dead in the bombing and shootings. In PM tonight, full coverage as the gunman appears in court. We'll hear from Norway's Prime Minister.
I believe that Norway will change. We will have a Norway before and a Norway after, but we will still be a society which is very clear on our values.
With the BBC News, Alan Smith.
The man accused of the bombing and mass shootings in Norway has made a brief court appearance in Oslo. He pleaded not guilty to charges of terrorism. Police say the number of people killed on the island of Utøya is lower than previously thought. 68 people are now believed to have died there, instead of the initial estimate of 86. Eight were killed in the bombing in Oslo, an increase of one. Reporting from Oslo, our correspondent John Brain.
With the world's media having converged on the Oslo courthouse, Anders Breivik had hoped to use his appearance as a platform to explain the beliefs which inspired his lethal attacks. In the event, journalists and members of the public were denied entry, and the hearing was held behind closed doors. Afterwards, the judge, Kim Hager, revealed the defendant had said the killings were necessary to prevent Europe being taken over by Muslims. He'd also claimed there were two other cells in his organisation. Breivik has been remanded in custody for 8 weeks, the first four of which he will be held in isolation.
A minute's silence was observed across Norway at midday local time in memory of those killed in the attacks. Thousands of people stood with heads bowed at a ceremony led by King Harald of Norway and the country's Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg. They signed a book of condolence at the main university in Oslo. In a BBC interview, Mr. Stoltenberg said it was a difficult time for the whole country and for him as Prime Minister.
At the same time, I feel actually privileged to have the opportunity to be able to speak to people, to comfort people, to convey messages of love, of care from all Norwegians to those who have lost their loved ones and all those who are now in still really are in deep shock.
Thanks, Alan. When PM came on the air on Friday, it was with news of two deaths in the bombing outside government buildings in Oslo. A few minutes into the programme, we heard from the Norwegian journalist Lars Bevanger. While we were all focused on the bombing, he broke to us the news of an even more deadly attack.
Several Norwegian media, including the state broadcaster, are now saying there have been shooting at a gathering of the youth wing of the Norwegian Labour Party. Now, they are gathered every year around this time on an island in the Oslo Fjord, and there are reports that a person dressed as a policeman, several sources say this, have been firing a handgun towards the crowds. And the Prime Minister, you just talked about him, has also confirmed that there is a serious situation developing there.
Now, of course, we know much more about what happened on that island and the man who was responsible. And in a moment, we'll hear from a journalist who was among the first to witness events there. This morning at 11 o'clock UK time, Norway paused.
For å minnes ofrene fra regjeringsbygget.
To remember the victims from our government buildings and at Utøya, I hereby declare 1 minute silence across our country.
They stopped work at the stock market and at Norway's airports and railway stations. Cars stopped in the streets and the drivers got out and stood as traffic lights changed from red to green. Outside Oslo's main university in the drizzle, the King and Queen stood alongside the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, whose voice you just heard. The group was flanked by two burning torches. Thousands of people bowed their heads in silence. Thousands more stood around a carpet of flowers nearby outside Oslo Cathedral. Mr. Stoltenberg said the tragedy had only served to strengthen Norway's determination to uphold the principles of democracy and freedom.
In the middle of all this tragedy, I am proud to live in a country that has managed to stand at such a critical moment, to stand together. I'm impressed by how much people have shown each other of firmness care for each other. We're a little, we're a small country, but we're a proud people. We are still shaken by what hit us, but we will not give up, and we will not give up our values. Our answer is more democracy, more openness, and more humanity, but never naivety.
But at almost the same moment, that desire for more openness was being tested in a very direct way. At a courthouse where the flag was flying at half-mast, the man who says he was solely responsible for the bombing and the shootings was due to appear within the hour, and legal argument was raging about whether that appearance should be in the open, with the media present, or behind closed doors. Reporting for PM from outside the court, Chris Morris.
Evening, Eddie. Yes, Anders Behring Breivik didn't quite get his wish, a day in court with the whole world listening. Instead, it was behind closed doors. The only glimpse of the accused wearing a red T-shirt with stubble and shorter hair than in some of his internet images was on his way in and out of court in a black 4x4 amid tight security. After it was over, the judge, Kim Hager, ordered Breivik to be detained for 8 weeks with no visitors other than his lawyer. The judge said Breivik had admitted to carrying out the attacks, and although he had said he'd acted alone, he also claimed he was working with, quote, two other cells. But this question, why, if he was motivated by a hatred of Muslims and multiculturalism, did he choose to attack specific targets associated with Norway's governing Labour Party? Here's the judge speaking through a female interpreter.
The objective of the attacks was to give a sharp signal, in quotes, to the people. The accused wishes to induce the greatest possible loss to the Labour Party so that it for the future will limit new recruitment. The accused explained that the Labour Party has failed the country and the people, and the price of their treason is what they had to pay yesterday.
Well, as we've heard from the Prime Minister and others, there is tremendous determination that these appalling events won't change this traditionally liberal country too much. But there's also anger. There were a few people outside the court who made that clear. One of them was Kim, who works in a local cafe. Was he there because he wanted to say something to the accused?
According to the law, the judge can decide to close the doors if investigation purposes makes it necessary. The other reason that was given was because of security. I think he should allow a smaller group of journalists to attend the case.
So some access without sort of turning it into a media circus,
yeah,
really?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Can Breivik get a fair trial? Does he deserve one?
Well, of course, this is a challenge to our legal system. That is the case always when the actual crimes rise, a lot of emotions.
Do you think this case will spark any debate in Norway about multiculturalism, immigration, alienation among some?
Oh, sure it will. That debate has already started, and I'm happy that our government and all the political parties have stated very clearly that Norway is a society for all kinds of religions, for all kinds of races.
Do you think that will remain the majority view?
An act like this is very bad for developing a society in the direction I just mentioned, because it awakes so many emotions, and the acts are so disgusting. I think it's part of the human nature that they will try to find what I would call easy ways to stop that kind of things. And we should continue to develop our free, open society for all people who are here.
Well, of course, that wasn't an angry professor, angry protester. That was a law professor here in Oslo, Stale Eskeland. I was talking to him about the way this case could develop. But as I said earlier, there were some angry people outside court. One of them was Kim. And I asked him, was he there because he wanted to say something to the accused?
No, I would just have spat him in his face. Don't have any words. What can you say to a madman that would help? Nothing. For me, he could just be carried away, done something else with. He doesn't even need any court martial or anything. You just put him in, forget it.
Now, in the last hour, a police press conference has been going on. One piece of good news, if you like, they believe the number of dead is slightly lower than feared. Instead of 93, 76. The number at the lake has mercifully been slightly reduced. But what about this idea that perhaps Breivik wasn't acting alone, there were other people acting with him? Here's what the police had to say.
Their meeting earlier today in court had to be closed because we worried about giving out too much information. One of the reasons was that we thought that other people might be implicated. This is partly based on this information that there might be two other cells. I cannot, because of the investigation, give any concrete answers on this subject. Mr. Breivik has said that he is on his own, but the other information says the opposite. And the investigation have to clarify this.
Well, right now, Eddie, people are starting to gather for a peace march here in Oslo. They've been asked to bring roses because the police have asked them not to carry torches. And just down the road from where I'm standing, they've been queuing outside the flower shop.
Chris Morris reporting. Marius Anin is a Norwegian journalist who on Friday found himself in a helicopter above the island of Utøya.
I normally actually work as a video journalist in the web department, mainly focusing on technology news. I usually work with technology, as I said, but I also spent the last 6 months in Afghanistan shooting a documentary for the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation, and I've been a lot in the Middle East.
What was Afghanistan like? What did you film there?
We were embedded with the Norwegian forces there and made a 6-episode documentary about our presence. So I was embedded with a squad and followed two guys for 6 months. Yeah, that was war.
What's it like seeing war close up?
I think seeing a modern warfare the way it's going on in the northern parts of Afghanistan is pretty much like a computer game. At least to me, I know it can be. I mean, it can be different, but it's initialized in really, really long distances with tanks starting to shoot, calling in bombers. You're kind of a spectator just watching it from a long distance. You don't smell anything. You don't see anything clearly. You can maybe see through binoculars, but you get a very, very distanced view of it.
Tell me about Friday. How did you come to be involved?
I actually got home on Friday. I had just finished work, and I turned on my TV and saw that the bomb had gone off in downtown Oslo. And at the exact same moment, my editor called and asked if I could come back because they just needed everyone to do stuff. When we arrived Oslo downtown, I got a text message up in the helicopter from my editor saying, "Go to Utøya, there's been report of shootings, be careful." And that was pretty much what we knew.
What did you see?
In the beginning, I told my pilot to just give me a big circle around it so I can do like the big overview shots, which is the best shots actually to take from a helicopter. I remember thinking when I looked down at the tent camp in the middle of the island that this island must have been evacuated by the police already because I couldn't see a living soul. And then seconds later, I lifted my sight and looked out in the water, and I saw dozens of people swimming in all directions. And then I think that's when we started to realize that something was terribly wrong down there.
What did you do then?
We circled the island a couple of times, and I started trying to shoot close-ups from the helicopter. Through my viewfinder, I could see that a lot of people were swimming. After a while, I also realized that a lot of people were drifting. They were lying dead by the shore, and a lot of people were hiding. You could clearly see that they were standing down by the water trying to hide from something. We had no idea at that time that there was one or 10, or we had no idea how many shooters there were. We didn't know that he was wearing a police uniform. So we were kind of confused, but we were starting to get the image.
What images stick in the mind?
Mostly of people floating and swimming off the island, because those are the clearest shots. Those and the images of the Delta Force, the police SWAT team arriving on the other side of the island and starting to clear the island, and kids running towards the policemen into safety.
Have you had a chance, I'm sure you've been very busy these past few days, have you had a chance to reflect on what you saw?
It was all pretty chaotic up in the helicopter and in the hours afterwards. But I sat down on Sunday and just went through the whole 18-minute tape and just trying to clear out what we had actually seen. And that helps a lot, both to get an overview and to get an impression of time and people and all those factors.
It just strikes me this is a much more close-up experience for you than even the war in Afghanistan that you talked about.
It is, and when going into a war zone, you kind of, whether you like it or not, you kind of prepare for it. You kind of think through every scenario that you might meet. You practice, you drill, you do first aid, you do all those things. This is just another day at work, and there is no way you can actually be prepared for the things that we saw up there.
What was it like witnessing that?
Luckily, I can. I don't get that affected when I'm at work. I try to just stay in this kind of a bubble, do my work, focus, zoom, take the images, not to like panic or to lose the grip, because that will do no one no good. And you're after all in a small helicopter that's without a door, so it's pretty stormy and pretty airy up there. So you have to just keep calm and do the best of it.
When you think about it now, does any part of you think maybe you should have come out of the bubble and stopped being the professional person you had to be? And I mean, was there anything you could have done to help these people?
No, not from my point of view. We had a very small helicopter, and there's no way we could have like landed or gone down or done anything like that. I think we the only thing we could do was actually to document what we saw up there and do that the best we could.
A lot of people are talking about how Norway should respond to what's happened. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think as a Norwegian, I would agree with the Labour Party and the Prime Minister and everyone saying, do not react the way this killer wants us to react. Don't react with hatreds, react with more democracy.
Marius Arnin, who was there on Friday, he mentioned the Prime Minister, and we heard from Jens Stoltenberg at that ceremony in Oslo earlier. He's given an interview to the BBC. You can hear some of that after 5:30. Also, an interview with a Nobel Peace Prize winner and his observations on Norway and what the country should do next.
The man accused of killing dozens of people in two attacks in Norway has told a court that there were two further cells in his organisation. Anders Behring Breivik said he carried out the shooting and car bombing because he wanted to save Norway and Western Europe from, among other things, a Muslim takeover. The hearing was held behind closed doors to avoid giving him a public platform. Police now say the number of people killed on the island of Utøya is 68, lower than the initial estimate of 86. They say 8 were killed in the bombing in Oslo. A spokesman said that even though fewer families were affected, it made no difference to the depth of the tragedy. His words are spoken by an interpreter.
It is the case that the fact that numbers confirmed dead has been reduced. It means that there are fewer people that have been affected, and that is positive in a situation which is deeply tragical.
More on Norway now. The country's Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg has been speaking to the BBC's John Sopel. Here's part of their conversation.
Norway is a country where we all feel very close to each other. We have never experienced anything like this before. We have to go back to the Second World War to find any kind of violence which is similar to what we experienced on Friday. Therefore, people in Norway are in deep grief, but we also see a Norway which is very unified, where people are standing really together to comfort each other and to take care of each other.
And I think you knew people who died.
I knew many of them, and I also knew many of the parents, relatives, friends of those who died, because some of them worked in the ministries, but most of them were participants at the Labour Party youth camp. That's a camp where I participated every summer since 1974. I was supposed to deliver a speech on the camp the day after the bomb.
Around the world there has been a great sympathy, hasn't there, towards your country?
There has been a great sympathy from all over the world. Heads of states, heads of government, they have phoned, expressed their condolences to me, and I have conveyed it further on to the people of Norway. Today we had 1 minute of silence in Norway, But that was not only in Norway, it was in all the Nordic countries. It was 1 minute of silence, expressing the respect of those who have lost their lives in Oslo and at the youth camp on Friday.
And Prime Minister, you made a plea, I think, in the immediate aftermath, that politics must not change. Norway must not change. It must remain an open society. Isn't it inevitable that Norway is not going to be as open a society as maybe it was?
I believe that Norway will change. We will have a Norway before and a Norway after the bomb attack and the killing. But I believe at the same time that Norway will be possible to recognize. We will still be a society which is very clear on our values of democracy, of openness, and a society where we welcome people to be active, to participate in political work in a way where they can feel safe.
How do you explain how a Norwegian citizen becomes fanatical and so extreme that they can do something like this?
I think that no society is able to 100% protect itself against acts of terror, acts of violence. We have conflicts, we have extreme people in Norway, and we have seen violence before, but we have never seen violence at a scale or anything like what we saw on Friday. And of course, we will learn, we will in some ways change, but I will do whatever I can to make sure that we do not change in a way which undermines our core values of openness, democracy and participation.
Norway's Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg talking to John Sopel. Will have more reflections on what Norway might want to do next a little bit later in the programme. Norway's in the news right now for those deadly acts of violence, but for more than 100 years it's been perhaps best known on the world stage for its promotion of peace through the Nobel Peace Prize. I've been hearing from Elie Wiesel, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986.
The first thing that happened was shock, total shock. Never would I have thought that that could happen in Norway. I've known Norway so well, so deeply. I have so many friends there on so many levels. And to think that in Norway, a young man, or anyway, a man who is not so old, could decide to do what he has done in Norway, to kill children, just one after the other. Somehow, it sounds absurd, surrealistic. It's not Norway. What happened to Norway? Norway will remain. Norway is a great country, it's a great nation with a great tradition of peace-seeking and peace efforts all over the world. We admire Norway. And now, all of a sudden, this... So should we change our view of Norway because of one person? I don't think so.
But I wonder whether Norway's view of the world will change.
Of the world, I don't think so. It will certainly change in different ways. It will try to understand what moved that young man or that man to do what he had done. What education did he receive? Who were his friends? What books did he read? I'm sure that they are going to do this inquiry in depth to understand what happened.
I'm just reading some of the words that the Nobel Committee used to describe you back in 1986. They called you a messenger to mankind, stating that through your struggle to come to terms with your own personal experience of total humiliation and the utter contempt for humanity shown in Hitler's death camps, as well as your practical work in the cause of peace, you delivered a powerful message of peace, atonement and human dignity to humanity. It's that sort of message that many people in Norway might be looking for now.
Well, of course, but the question will remain a question until they find some more material, more elements. What moved that man to become who he was? I'm not saying it has to be found because so others should not imitate him. I don't think he can be imitated. He went so out of his way to be an exception that there is no fear in me about others. But nevertheless, to understand, it is, after all, an event that will remain now in the history of Norway, which is a history of peace and the compassion. It's a good history. And now, from now on, whenever you will study the history of Norway, Norwegian people and its traditions and history, of course, his name will be part of it.
Do you think he showed utter contempt for humanity?
Oh, I think he showed utter contempt for whatever is noble in the human being. To go from one child to another and be killed, that means he killed the future. That's what he wanted. Not to change the future, but to kill the future. A child represents, incarnates the future. And he went, mainly children, he went one after the other, just killing, shooting, firing. That means something was about the future that frightened him, probably, or mystified him. But was his act a human act? Which means, can one be human by being inhuman? Of course, that is the question of all questions.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel.